Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another broadcast of Keeping It Real with Frankie D from the Johnnyville Broadcast Center on the Windy City Hometown Entertainment Network and Jack FM 89.7 WRHS FM Norwich. Today's subject will be about the Italian culture. And now, here is Frankie D.
Just what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant? Anyone knows an ant can't move a rubber tree plant.
But he's got high hopes, he's got high hopes, he's got high apple pie in the sky hopes.
So anytime you're getting low, instead of letting go, just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Welcome to Keeping It Real with Frankie D, your hometown Italian-American radio show. Today's show is a very exciting one. We have a star-studded cast to talk about Italo Balbo. We have experts on the Italo Balbo subject, on the man. We have an eyewitness to his landing in 1933 or 34. We're going to learn that today. So I want you to sit back, relax, and if you have any younger kids, high school kids, this is a history lesson waiting to happen. So we're going to start with Don Fiore, our expert on Italo Balbo. Don, thank you so much for being here. And let's start off by just talking a little bit about the man himself, like a little bit about his history.
Well, Balbo was born in Ferrara in the 1890s, and middle class family, and he pretty well educated. He volunteered for the Alpini divisions in World War I. He served with distinction, was wounded in action, not seriously. After the war, you know, Italy was convulsed with all sorts of economic problems and political problems after the war. They won the war, but they lost it.
Okay.
And economically, they didn't have a very good return to a peacetime economy.
Okay, but just to back up, just for the less intelligent people like myself, you said he was with the Alpini. Now, was he a flyer in World War One?
No, he was. He was very interested in aviation, but he never.
He wasn't an actual flyer.
No, he didn't.
Okay.
He didn't. He was an Alpini. Those were mountain divisions.
Okay.
After the war, Balbo was one of the many disgruntled veterans who united together to form the Fasci di Combattimento, which was the National Fascist Party. And I think that people, you know, become nervous when they hear that word. But let's put this in the context of 1918, 1919, okay?
Please do, yes.
Such a dirty word.
Right.
In modern society. He was one of the four, what they call quadrumvirs, founders of the party. One of them was Benito Mussolini.
He was one of the founders. Yes. Of the party.
Yeah, he was one of the four.
With Mussolini.
Mussolini and Cesare Vecchi and Emilio Di Bono. Each one was appointed a district in the town to organize politically.
And this was
1919.
So, right. Like, quickly after World War II completed.
Yeah, almost immediately.
Okay.
And after that, we know, of course, the Fascist Party won a majority in Parliament by 1922.
Okay.
And, well, not a majority. They had a big standing in Parliament. And there was a crisis, yet another crisis, every 5 months, 6 months, political, economic crisis. And the fascists were agitating for a bigger role in government and the premiership. And they staged their march on Rome. This is getting way, but Balbo was one of the participants in this. And to make a long story short, the king, His Majesty Vittorio Emanuele, Terzo was the king of Italy at that time. He appointed Benito Mussolini the prime minister.
Oh, he appointed him prime minister. Okay.
Right, in 22. Okay, and then the following year, Mussolini instituted the Regia Aeronautica Italiana, which was the Royal Italian Air Force. Italy was the second country in the world to have an independent air force, not like an army air. But Britain was the first with the Royal Air Force, and then the Royal Italian Air Force founded in 1923.
Okay.
Okay, when we celebrate, when we do the Balboa flight, that's the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Air Force. That was the
Okay, so 10 years after they founded the Air Force, they did the famous flight. So it was 1933.
33.
Okay.
And the first what's the word I'm looking for? The guy in charge of the Air Force.
Okay.
So it sounds silly. He was Alofinzi, and he was another first-day fascist member. And I think it's interesting that he was also Jewish, and that's something that's kind of
he was
covered up.
Jewish?
Yeah, because the fascists were not, they were not racist. Like, we identify them with the Nazis and everything, but a lot of the fascists, not a lot, but a good representation of all types.
That's very interesting.
Anyway, but Finzi had to resign because of a scandal, and I won't get into that because it's very complicated.
Okay.
And there was an interim general appointed, but he was from the army, had no interest in aviation. And then Mussolini, he was just a guy, like a transitional guy, appointed Italo Balbo.
Okay. So Balbo really had like simple upbringing, and he kind of ascended pretty high.
He was very intelligent and very well educated.
Okay.
Okay, so he wasn't like any rough, he was, I don't want to call him the intellectual of the party, but because Mussolini was pretty well educated too. He wasn't rough around the edges at all.
Okay.
He was a very
distinguished gentleman.
That might go into
play. Oh, okay.
He just
okay.
was a very capable okay. person.
Okay.
Young. And you know, the whole thing about fascism was it celebrated youth and that
okay.
was the type of thing. So Balbo was when he became air minister, he was the youngest air minister in the world, national air minister.
I mean, that's very impressive.
Right,
yes.
It is.
Yeah.
And he also promptly learned how to fly a plane because he felt if you're going to be an air minister, you should at least know
so
how to fly
a plane. So at
that
point, he was not a pilot.
He was not a pilot, but he quickly learned.
Right.
And he got his wings. And then,
okay.
And he made sure, because Alofinzi initiated that everybody in the Regia Aeronautica, from a guy, the clerk in the file cabinet, to the mechanic, everybody had to know how to fly a plane.
Wow.
If you were in the Air Force.
So that's kind of interesting that he wasn't a pilot till then.
But he wasn't. He was a great admirer of aviation, and
okay.
I think if things would have played out differently, he probably would have enlisted for the Air Corps in Italy.
Okay.
In the war.
Okay.
So, as air minister, he mm-hmm. was also one of the few air ministers in the world who knew how to fly a plane, and what he initiated after that was he started staging these mass flights to different parts of the world. There was a lot of reasons behind this, and one of the reasons was Italy still had a lot of surplus airplanes from World War One.
World War One, okay.
Enormous amount of planes. They constructed over 11,000 aircraft for the war.
Wow.
Italians started out with 70 when the war started, and by the war it was ended.
From 70 to 11,000.
11,000.
Wow.
Yeah. But after the war, they had all these planes. So what the purpose of a lot of these goodwill mass flights were, or before they became mass flights, they were individual flights by individual Italian aviators all over the world. And the idea was to try to find markets for their planes. There were demonstrations of how good our aircrafts were.
For selling the planes.
For selling the planes.
Okay.
Trying to find markets.
So they were advertising their planes
right.
so they would be purchased.
That wasn't the main stated purpose.
Mm-hmm.
That was the
mm-hmm.
bottom purpose. The main
okay.
was a goodwill flight.
Okay.
Okay? So Balbo felt that the individual aviators flying here and there around the world kind of undercut the idea of fascist Italy, which was supposed to be we're all united working together, and encourage everybody to be looking at this one particular aviator instead of the Air Force in itself. So he instituted a series of mass flights, sometimes involving as many as 60 planes. He sent 60 planes to Spain. I think he sent another 30 or 40 to the Soviet Union. And these were just flights to show what we can do.
Okay. So in Europe, he was flying
around here and there.
Yeah.
And then in 31, he flew to South America with 12 planes.
Now, that had to be a pretty big deal as well.
It was 32?
Don, I think it was 24 planes. It was a mass flight, like the one in Chicago.
Yeah, no, the South American one wasn't 24. I know that for a fact.
29. 1929.
Oh, 1929.
Oh, 1929 was up in
They flew into Rio.
Right.
And I believe they still have one of his planes in a museum there.
Everybody says that.
That's rotting away.
Rotting away. Everybody says that. That particular plane that they have there was actually a Portuguese aviator flew across the Atlantic in one of the S-55s. But the Italian aviators had flown in 28. Two aviators had made that same crossing. And so Balbo was following that route. But the key here was it was with a mass flight. That's the distinguishing thing that we're going to find with this.
Right. So how do we get to, how does it all come about for him to come to Chicago?
Well, 33. Well, Balbo came here a couple times to the United States for different aviation conventions and things like that. And he got to meet so many people. He became friends with people like Henry Ford, Amelia Earhart, people like that. Okay. So he had a lot of contacts in America.
So he was like a worldly statesman.
By this time, he is.
By this time, he's
very well known.
Okay.
And he also hosted several aviation conventions in Italy for international pilots and things like that
to work
out the details of transatlantic flight and transcontinental flight.
Okay.
They had to work all that out as far as boundaries and stuff.
Right.
He was in the forefront with that type of thing. The 33, as we were approaching, the 1933 World's Fair, and the whole idea of the 33 World's Fair, as opposed to in Chicago with the 93 World's Fair.
93, right.
Which was kind of sitting back and looking at our great accomplishments and, how wonderful it is. Well, 33, we're in the midst of the Depression.
Okay.
Everybody's scared. Everybody doesn't know what the future is. And the mood of the 33 World's Fair was, let's put all of our faith and hope in science and technology. And that's why if you look at the fair, the architecture is real modern and everything like that. Totally different than the 93 fair, right?
Okay.
Flash Gordon. You know what I mean? This is the way of the future.
Now, does Chicago contact him to do this, or does he contact them?
They contacted Chicago because Chicago had, first of all, the Italians, they had the biggest representation internationally of all the international participants. The Italian pavilion was one of the biggest, if not the biggest. They were probably the best represented.
Okay. Wow.
As opposed to the 93 fair. Where
did Dominic Candelora have something to do with that? Or?
Could have been.
Mussolini was nothing if not aware of public relations. And the Italian, his administration, put a lot of effort into good public relations. And it fit because the World's Fair in 1933 was called the Century of Progress. Chicago was founded in 1833, and so now in 1933, we're celebrating a century of progress. And Mussolini saw the Italian Americans as an important asset that needed to be cultivated, and also the American public, the general American public, because he was pretty popular until about 1935. Throughout American public opinion.
Dominic, do you know, or does anyone here on our panel know, in 1933? What's a rough estimate of how many Italian Americans lived in Chicago?
It's hard to say. I'd say there were probably 150,000, 200,000.
Okay, well, that is a pretty big number. Yes.
The number is growing all the time because they're multiplying.
Right.
Even though not many new Italians were coming in the 1930s. They had big families, so it was getting bigger.
And the
consul general here, Giuseppe Castruccio, was very important and very instrumental in getting the Chicago people all excited about Balbo, getting all the clearances, etc.
Okay.
And he bought into the idea of having big representation at the World's Fair as a wonderful investment for all the things that Mussolini's administration wanted to do.
So the people were very excited with anticipation about this.
Yeah, and they had a really big display, and the building was made like an airplane, and Italians really invested in this. They wanted to sell airplanes, they wanted to sell fascism, to Italian Americans, especially. Okay. And
but what I was going to ask is the excitement does go beyond just the Italians here in Chicago, correct?
Oh yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
The entire city and all the different kinds of people were excited about this upcoming flight.
Take a look at the newspapers from the days surrounding the event, and they're Italians are mostly Balbo, but they're all over the newspaper in a big way in the front page and positive. It's like a second coming. It's like an astronaut.
Wow.
Big hero. And really, that's one of the reasons why we want to keep the name Balbo alive, because this was probably the proudest single moment in the history of Italian Americans in the United States, and especially in Chicago.
That is a very large statement. And I heard you say that before, and I mean, it's just such a powerful statement to think. Yes. And you said beyond just then, even to this day, it was, what did it say it again? The biggest one?
The proudest single moment in Italian American history, not just for Italians in Chicago, but the whole country.
Wow.
I will definitely endorse that.
You
statement.
Agree with that
Absolutely.
As well? Bill Dalcero, what do you think on that statement?
Please? No, I've talked to aviators at conferences and such. One came to Casa Italia a couple years ago. Non-Italians will talk about this. It's part of the history of aviation, period, in America. It was such an amazing achievement.
I mean, that is a huge statement. And I mean, when you sit back and you reflect on it, I mean, we're talking bigger than the 56-game hitting streak. We're talking bigger than the crooners out east.
Well, that's because I think
we're talking. Because if you really think with people, they think of those type of things. They think of the actors and the athletes.
It went beyond all that. It went beyond all that.
This type of thing, Frank, cast Italians in a role that the world never puts them in. They don't put them as technological leaders. That's the Germans, right? Or something
right.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Italians are supposed to be good with food and singing.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that's absolutely opposite.
They superseded Chef Boyardee.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so the whole thing, the excitement, the non-Italian and Italian excitement over this was because of the scope of this project. Up to that point, there's two things. Up to that point, we're still difficult to get one plane over the ocean, right?
Okay.
Let alone 24. In perfect formation. The other thing is, when we think of aviators in that era, you think of Wiley Post or Charles Lindbergh, daring guy hopping in the cockpit.
Right.
You know, throwing his fate to the wind and doing it. Well, this flight had nothing of that. It was so carefully planned out and carefully executed, you could only compare it to an Apollo moonshot today. You know, it was 3 years in the planning, and it was to the point where nothing was overlooked. We saw the planes flying, but if you could see the ground organization that was organized to get this thing to happen, was 50 times more people involved, 50,000 times more people involved, right?
That is amazing. See, I got to be honest, I don't think Italian Americans understand this. I don't think they can appreciate the impact of this. Definitely not today's generation. I don't even think the last generation, and I wonder about the one before that.
That's because of the war got in the way.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of other reasons. But
at this point, I would like to introduce our eyewitness. Now, if you think every show can get an eyewitness for a 1933 event, you're out of your mind, okay? This was not easy. Walter Santi, thank you for being here. You were there. Tell us about it.
It's a good number of years that I'd like to forget, but I'm still around kicking.
Oh, God bless.
But I remember Balbo was the one thing that sanitized the image of being Italian. One problem we had a lot of Italians that were coming here to get into the Industrial Revolution, leaving behind the agricultural economy that they were accustomed to. In that era, they didn't have radio, newspapers, electrification. They worked in the fields. One town was stranger to the next town. They were divided.
Right.
But when they came here and Bob will pull that flight off, it sort of sparked an idea in the public that, hey, you know, there has to be some intelligent Italians in there, because they went from carving wood to making steel into modern airplanes.
Right.
And, you know, Italy didn't have many materials to work with, and the first planes they made were flying boats.
Okay.
They were wood. And the one thing we marveled about, and we talked about this with Dom Fiore a few years ago, is we wondered how they could get those massive engines up on a wooden hull. And I remember to this day seeing cranes pull them off of land, pulling them up from the engines and dropping them into the sea.
Wow.
And those planes had a perfect safety record.
Wow.
But you got to remember, in those days, they didn't have control towers. Everybody was using common sense to land and take off. And unfortunately, they had a landing accident on the way in, which destroyed a plane, and they lost one on the way back. So they started out with 25 planes, and they were down to 23.
23, okay.
But they were flawless.
So you were standing there in the street when this happened?
I was on the back porch on a hot summer day.
Okay.
And, of course, it was unannounced, and we just heard a big roar.
Wow.
And the ground was shaking. Windows were rattling. The dishes were rattling. And, of course, they didn't have any rules of how high you could fly or low you could fly.
Okay.
And they were very low. And I remember this odd configuration of a flying hull with two rods holding the tail in the back.
Okay.
And it caught everybody by surprise. It was deafening. And everybody that was near a car was honking the horn.
Wow.
And you saw all 24 of them go by from your back porch.
Oh, my God.
And they circled the city. But, you know, that takes you back to where it all started, because the Italians in Chicago were a divided group. They came from their own areas, and it wasn't prejudice that they had for another group, but it was that one group was steering everybody to where the jobs were.
Okay.
And that's how the economy worked at that time. You found a bunch of Italians from one part of Italy working in one place because they had an in with the boss.
Right.
But, you know, the American public at that time perceived Italians to be a dumb lot. You know, when they saw Balbo pulling the stunt off, they says, hey,
it all changed.
How could they do this in a short time? And
did it bring a unity to the Italians as well?
Pardon?
Did it bring a unity to the Italians?
Well, I think it did. It brought in a sense of unity and pride that, you know, people could look up to an Italian and say, hey, your countrymen really got something on the line to pull something like that off, because it had never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
Aviation wasn't organized. There were no control towers. They had powerful engines. They had a great range, but they could only fly in the daylight hours.
Okay.
And, of course, they followed coastal areas, and they went only so many miles until it was dark. And the Italian Navy did have some picket ships along the way that would feed them some information, but that was the extent of it.
So educate me. The significance of this flight is the amount of planes, the distance, the year, everything combined.
It was the planning.
The planning of it. And
as Walter alluded to, along the route, they had a fleet of ships beneath the flight pattern, he called picket ships. Part of their purpose was to give almost constant ground surface-to-air communication and weather reports,
right?
Wind temperature, everything.
This
like that
had to cost the government a lot of money, right?
Amount of money.
An enormous amount of money.
Right. And it would be on par, like I say, almost our space program.
Wow.
Given Italy's economy and the state of technology back then.
Okay.
They had, all along the way, they had refueling points that had whole staffs, meteorologists, mechanics.
My God, it had to be an astronomical amount of money.
An enormous investment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
this got people thinking that airlines could be commercially successful.
That's it.
That's
really?
The point is, it was foreshadowed commercial aviation. And the whole idea of not taking any risks, like the Lindberghs and Post did, the the idea of that exactly the way you want it to be if you have commercial aviation, right? And they have every precaution.
So prior to this, there was no commercial airlines?
Well, very, very rudimentary. Very rudimentary. Italy was had the third largest in Europe, actually, in the 20s, but very rudimentary.
Okay.
You know, they didn't have planes, obviously, the size to carry that many
passengers
yet.
But in the 30s now, I thought I had heard you say this because I attended a talk that you gave about this subject. Italy was number one for aviation in these years in the world?
I don't want to call it number one. It was definitely one of the leaders.
Okay.
In aviation, probably the top three.
Okay.
In the world as far as manufacturing, as far as technological lead.
That's amazing because
they had around 32 actual manufacturers by the 1930s.
That's amazing because, you know, as we always, you know, are accustomed to the stereotype and, you know, it's food and not smart people and old world and all that. And this really goes against all of that, doesn't it, Bill?
Yes, it does.
I mean, it makes you sit back and think about that.
Yeah, well,
it was an historic event, like Dan says. Aviators who are non-Italian today still talk about it when they talk about great achievements in aviation. When you look at it in that context, it's great.
If World War II didn't happen, I mean, we'd have a whole different landscape here.
Right.
Okay, really?
That's what brought everything down. Most of the aircraft companies in Italy, and they were really flourishing in the 30s.
Yeah.
And a good export market, too. Very few of them survived the war. So, and they had a really hard time coming back. I mean, look at Piaggio. Piaggio was an aircraft builder. After the war, they were building little motor schools.
Right, the little Vespas.
Vespas. They were actually
building planes. They went to Vespas.
Sure, yes. Right. And you see that all the way down. So many of their companies did that.
You got to remember, Italians always put some new ideas in the planes that we use today. Like when Lindbergh was flying, they were all open cockpit planes.
Right.
And Lindbergh was flying by the seat of his pants. He was following railroad tracks, road maps, never flew at night. But, you know, an Italian pioneer in this country introduced the enclosed cabin, which Lindbergh wanted to buy. Yeah. It was his first choice of a plane until he said, no, you've got to have an observer with you. And Lindbergh didn't want it. That's why he went to an inferior plane. But he had a much better plane.
Wow.
The Italians were great for record breaking. I think they held almost number one with all world records in the 30s. So much so that two of their records set in the 30s held all the way till the 1990s, unbroken. That's how advanced
they were. What kind of records are we talking
about? Well, they had an altitude record for piston engine and then seaplane.
Oh, I see. Okay.
A record in 34 of 440 miles per hour, and that was not.
It held up for.
Yeah, that was not broken until the 90s, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah. The thing is the Italians were great in the laboratory,
mm-hmm.
but they had a hard time translating this into mass production.
Okay.
Because the economy wasn't quite there yet.
Right.
Balbo must have really liked the United States because, after all, when he got here, there was a gigantic parade and demonstration, and they wouldn't let them go to sleep, the party after party. Then he went to New York
and got the
same thing. So I think he must have had a warm spot in his heart for America and the way Americans do things.
Really?
Well, you're very right on that because we had a paisano that had an Italian eatery near the area near the downtown area, near the Drake Hotel where they were staying. And naturally, when they found this Italian eatery, they would come in, and a whole flock of them would be on the sidewalk, walking up and down, and they would drew crowds. You know, people were just amazed. And I think, well, he's no longer there, but he kept the pen that one of the pilots gave him.
Sure.
And it was one of his treasured pieces.
Wow.
You know, to Dominic's point, though, that's one of the reasons why Balbo fell out of grace, okay, because he had so many friends in Italy. As Italy got closer and closer to the alliance with the German Nazis, Balbo and most of the old guard were very much opposed to that.
Mm-hmm.
He had too many friends here to want to pick a fight with the West.
Here in the United States.
In the United States and in England.
Okay.
And he was totally against the alliance with Germany, totally against the racial laws, and this led to his ultimate demise.
He sounds like like I said, like a world statesman, like a very likable character that made friends in all over the world, and you know, people seem to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, so much so as when he was, you know, he was shot down over Tobruk shortly after the war started with the British, and the British actually sent an airplane over the enemy lines to drop a wreath, which is just totally unheard of.
Wow.
Okay, at the place where his plane was shot down.
Okay.
And because they felt that aviation and they had lost a personal friend, even though he represented the enemy.
Another, right, the enemy.
So, to give you an idea, of where he stood in this.
Do you know of any writings where he expresses this admiration for the U.S. and hatred for the racial laws?
Yeah, well, the racial laws, several, as far as I don't know if he committed anything to writing, but there are accounts where he walked into Mussolini's office. And, you know, he was one of the few people who would address Mussolini as two. You know, everybody else was voi. You know,
okay. Oh, I see. So he was talking to him at his level instead of...
Because they were both together when they were both on
they were equals.
Nothings. Right.
Right.
So he would come in and sit on Mussolini's desk. And when the racial laws were being discussed, he said, "Why are you licking Germany's boots?" is what he said to him.
Babo said this to Mussolini.
And Mussolini later said, "I can't guarantee the future of that man." Which, you know, you can take it any way you want. But there's accounts to where he took his Jewish friends, the day after they passed the law, he took all of his Jewish friends out to dinner, publicly.
He made a public display of it.
Yeah.
And then he kind of fell out of graces as well with...
Yeah, well, I think the Jewish thing, even Mussolini didn't take that seriously.
Oh.
Okay, but as far as questioning Mussolini's authority,
okay,
and his popularity was so huge.
Okay.
Everybody assumed that he was going to be the logical successor to Mussolini, right? And I don't think Mussolini was ready for that yet. But he did have, as Dominic pointed out, he did have a great love for the United States. Matter of fact, when he reformed the Italian Air Ministry and the Aviation Department, he tried to put in a lot of American ideas, which such as you show up to work at 8:30, not at 10:30.
Oh, okay.
You get a half hour for lunch.
Really?
And
that's interesting.
Totally alien.
Yeah.
And these were all things that he had learned when he had been in the United States.
Okay.
And saw how the United States.
And they also ate at the same time at the same bench.
Yeah, right. But I mean, really, he was very serious about that.
Okay.
And
standing up.
He had to. Yeah, exactly. Standing up, and you're back at no walk in the park.
Right.
You're back at the desk. Okay. So. He did pick up a lot of those things and tried to translate them into the Italian way of doing things.
Okay.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, the politics does create strange bedfellows. Before the war, Mussolini was very popular in America. As a matter of fact, they had a Broadway song, "You're the Tops." One line went, "You're the Tops, you're Mussolini."
Yeah.
Then when the war came about, they erased that line.
I was going to say, was the line?
Yeah.
"You're the Mona Lisa," I think.
Well, yeah.
But the original line was, "You're the Mussolini."
You can find quotes from everything.
Dry martini.
Mahatma Gandhi praising Mussolini, right? I mean, everybody did in the 30s. Roosevelt did. I mean, matter of fact, well, De Balbo had lunch with Roosevelt, which is something that everybody forgets.
Huh.
But when he stopped off at Washington, because he went to Arlington Cemetery to put a wreath on the tomb of the unknown American soldier, and then lunch with Roosevelt.
With the President of the United States.
Right.
Wow.
So, go ahead.
Okay.
Well, another thing I remember is the word fascist was a sanitary word until they got into the war.
Yeah, Stalin used that.
Yeah. They got into the war. All of a sudden, it was a dirty word.
Yeah. Wow.
What does fascist mean?
Tribune writer... Tribune writers, especially, several editorials came out that Balbo should be renamed because he was a fascist.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. Now, in Chicago, so he leaves, we name a street after him.
That's right.
Balbo Drive.
Right.
How many years after his departure did we name that, do you know?
Oh, it was
immediate
summer.
Oh, it was that summer.
Yeah.
Okay, so they named the street right by Grant Park, I believe, Balbo Drive.
Yeah,
and then tell us about the famous column.
Oh, well, the column, the following year, Mussolini sent a column from a Roman temple in Ostia, Italy, to Chicago as a gift.
As a gift to honor the...
To thank Chicago for the
okay
warm reception.
Okay, where is this column located?
The column is located at the exact spot of where the Italian Pavilion stood at the World's Fair.
Wow.
It's in Burnham Park.
Okay.
It's you have to look for it to find it. And it's kind of weathering away. I think the Park District deliberately wants to keep it obscure.
Okay, so he sent a column, and it's on a base. The base was made here, and it says on the column, you know what it says?
Yeah, it says, it's in commemoration. It's got a poetic description, but the most interesting thing is in the 11th year of the fascist era is what's there. On the four corners of the column, or of the base, are fascies.
Okay.
I mean, it's really in your face as far as that. There was a second monument that was constructed the following year for Columbus, on Roosevelt and Michigan?
It's in Michigan.
Michigan Avenue, yeah.
And at the base of that, there's a plaque that says this monument has seen the glory of the wings of Italy led by Italo Balbo.
Really?
1933. And there's four allegorical figures representing different virtues, and one of them representing courage or whatever is Benito Mussolini. It's actually a sculpture, and the public has no idea that this
is. And that's there as well.
That's still there, but nobody talks
and
about it.
And you've told me in the past that every so often they look to change the name of Balbo Drive.
That's with such regularity.
And it's strictly because they're saying he was...
Yeah, it's based on...
he was a fascist.
Yeah, he was a fascist, and some outrageous things have been said based on very little research. Even the Chicago Tribune, very, very disappointed that a major newspaper would do such minimum research, because 2 years ago, I believe it was, a group of college professors had passed around, they all signed a petition saying, that it's disgraceful, might as well name the street, Hermann Goering Drive. And blah, 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 okay? So the Tribune seized on that, and they did an editorial. And one of the lines that they said in their petition was, even in Italy, this is a direct quote, where his crimes are well known, there's no monument or anything in tribute to Balbo. Now, if anybody took the time to do a simple Google search.
Okay.
Just type in Via Italo Balbo.
Yes.
And see, I mean, there's
how many
will
show
up?
There are out there.
There's a spot in Rome in the Fiumicino Airport called Piazzale Italo Balbo.
There is.
Wow. So obviously, nobody at the Tribune or these professors
did any research.
Took that amount of time to see. Do you know what you're talking about?
Wow.
So we wrote the Italic Institute put together a counter petition. We were able to get, I think, 900 signatures.
Good for you.
Saying, lascia stare,
Okay, right.
There comes a point when it's no longer political, but now it's historical. And this is a part of our history, it's part of aviation history, and
it's part of Chicago history as well. Mm-hmm. We can't let that happen.
I have an interesting anecdote about Balbo being shot down. I actually have a neighbor that was a soldier on that airfield.
Yeah.
He was an immigrant. He served in the Italian Army 5 years. He was there on a day he was shot down. And I said, in the newspapers they said Mussolini shot him down because he was jealous. He was stealing his thunder. And he says, well, I don't think it was that. He says, that particular day we had so many air raids on the field that everybody was trigger happy. They shot first and asked questions next.
I talked to somebody who claimed, pretty upright guy, to be the Radio Marconista at Tobruk with the Italian Army. Radio Marconista is the telegraph operator. And he said their instructions were to shoot down all aircraft regardless. And you repeat all aircraft regardless. Now, here's the thing about that. The anti-aircraft guns the Italians had, the Italians flew tri-motors. The British didn't fly tri-motors. They had no tri-motors in their fleet. So there's no way you can mistake Balbo's plane for a British plane.
So they're saying that it was accidentally shot down.
It was taking him out. Now, there's all kinds of rumors. There's one rumor that he was trying to cross and go over to the British lines. He was trying to get to Egypt because he didn't want to fight this war. All the way up until the minute that war was declared, he was continuously protesting this war. We don't have a chance that he repaired because we're totally unequipped here. Balbo was in Libya. He was the governor of Libya. That's what happened to him after he came back.
Mussolini
took him out of the aviation man, Governor
Lydia. Has Balbo ever been featured in a movie? any of his activities?
No. No. There's footage. There's footage out there now, but not a movie.
He wasn't that boxer in 76,
no,
Rocky.
No, that was not Balboa. That was Balboa.
Oh, Balboa. I'm sorry. I get those two confused all the time.
Well, it would make a great story.
It would make a tremendous story.
What was just said about him maybe going over to the British and then being killed at that point. And then I like the idea of a novel or a major feature film called Balbo's Flight that traces the interaction between the Italians and the Italian Americans.
I think it would be
when
great.
He comes to Chicago and they're in New York, love affairs.
Well, maybe this show is going to be a
and that kind of thing.
Well, it'll spring some interest in Balbo. And what is Balbo Day? You said it's this summer?
Oh, well, this summer we want to have a low-key observance of Italo Balbo's
What day would that
great
be?
Flight. That was on July 15th. That's the
July
day
15th.
That he arrived. It was a little bit late because of bad weather, but it was July 15th, 1933. And we're going to go over to the Balbo Column and just have a picnic.
All are welcome. I have 2 points that I need to clear up before we end the show. You said, the Tribune said, his war crimes? Did he commit
the
war crimes?
Said, well, here's what the thing was. You know, it was pretty, certainly not war crimes. Boy, there's so much misinformation out there.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know what, Helen, I know we could talk about this for about 12
Helen
hours.
Helen Schiller, the Alderman.
Absolutely, yes.
She put a petition out back, I believe it was in the late 90s, to change it to Nelson Mandela Drive because she said Balbo was killed dropping bombs on Africans from Mussolini. I mean, you got these things going on. They never, in fantasy,
and that's,
never
that's
happened.
Not true at all.
Okay.
Well, the Italian Air Force did drop bombs
in Ethiopia in 1936.
But didn't the American Air Force do the same thing?
And Balbo was not in.
Wasn't even involved in that.
Yeah, he was already governor of Libya by 1936, so he had nothing to do with that. It's difficult to. They made a point of the concentration camps in Libya. Now, there were concentration camps in Libya under General Graziani, who was the governor. Before Balbo.
Okay.
When Balbo took over, he tore them all down.
Oh,
and let
okay.
everybody out.
So this was just.
Yeah, I mean, it just everything opposite.
Right.
Of what this guy did. He was probably the most democratic governor, certainly more than the British governors in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There's a lot
Seems to be another case of if there's an Italian involved, they
and
just want to take it
the
away.
The word fascism is what triggers it off.
Right.
Fascism, he must be evil.
Right,
oh,
right.
Okay. What does the word fasci mean?
Fasci, you know what it means. A fasci is this. See that picture?
Yeah, I know it's a symbol,
it's
but
a symbol.
What?
It's a bundle. Okay.
Okay.
And it's got two meanings. One is bundle of unity.
Okay.
Okay, we're all, when you say a fascio,
that's not bad.
Like some of the unions.
Okay.
The leftist unions even would call themselves fascio di whatever.
Okay.
Which means bundle of, you know.
Unity,
whatever.
That's good.
The also, this was the emblem of the Roman lictors in ancient Rome, and it represented their power to punish evildoers, right?
Oh, okay.
Or criminals.
Okay.
By the rods and the axe.
Okay,
okay,
I see. Okay.
So that's kind of appealed to the. Now what went on in the early years of fascism, there was a lot of street brawls.
Okay.
And there was a lot of bloodshed on both sides, communists and fascists. There was a lot of murder, a lot of things went on. You have to understand the mentality of the average fascist back then. He was a war veteran, right? And he had seen his buddies die in the war, everything like that. And then when you see a gathering of communists, and I am totally political down the middle here, okay?
Okay.
But they would burn the Italian flag. Just
oh.
like, so you can imagine the reaction of these guys,
right.
just like American veterans.
They would be quite upset.
You know, we fought for that flag,
sure.
right?
That makes sense.
So there'd be lots of stuff like that went on.
Okay.
And we could talk
okay.
all evening about that. But yeah, that was ugly. But by 25, this is history.
Right. Well,
right?
We must keep that name of that street. We must keep that column. We will fix it. That is our goal. Real quick, what was the name of the Italian that invented the closed cockpit? You were saying it earlier.
I think it was Belanca.
Belanca. I just thought maybe some people in the audience would like to know. Gentlemen, this has been a truly exceptional show. quite educational, quite informative, quite enjoyable. Thank you, Walter Santi, Bill Dalcero, Dominic Candeloro, and Don Fiore, so much for coming here and enlightening us and giving us all your knowledge about this. As we always do, the quote of the show will end the show. I picked my favorite of all time. It's from Daniel Burnham, who was responsible, a big part of the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, a Chicago architect who planned a lot of the lakefront. He says, and I quote, "Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood, and probably themselves will not be realized. Make big plans. Aim high in hope and work, remembering that a noble logical diagram once recorded will never die. But long after we are gone, will be a living thing in itself, with ever-growing insistency. Remember that our sons and daughters are going to do things that would stagger us." I love that quote. And with that, thank you once again. Thank you, John DeVita, Kevin Saswick, and it's been a great show. And Italian-Americans, be proud of Italo Balbo and fight for the name of that street, and we're going to fix that column as well. Thank you. Have a great day.
Just what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant? Anyone knows an ant can't move a rubber tree plant.
But he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He's got high apple pie in the sky.
So anytime you're getting low, instead of letting go, just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
You have been listening to Keeping It Real with Frankie D and his guest on Jack FM 89.7 WRHS FM Norwich and the Windy City Hometown Entertainment Network. We want to give a special thank to Kevin Zeflik of WRHS-FM Norwich and the executive producer of Windy City Hometown Entertainment Network, Mr. John Secondo. This broadcast was pre-recorded on Wednesday, May the 13th, the year 2015. Until next time, please be safe and thanks for listening.
I hope so. Anytime you're feeling bad, instead of feeling sad, just remember that ram. Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt
dam. Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt dam.
Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt dam.
And this is Jack FM 89.7 WRHS FM, Norwich, Illinois.